Welcome to Sanity, a podcast by the New York Sun. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and every week, along with my co-host Rebecca Sugar, we try to make sense out of the nonsense and deliver some sanity to your week. We have a full program today. We're going to start off with our top story is the big, beautiful bill and Elon's departure from Washington and the future of Doge. Then our Make It Make Sense section, we're going to really drill down into two thorny issues that are at the centerpiece of Trump's agenda, really, on the immigration issue, the foreign student visa issue question, Harvard and elsewhere, as well as the news that just came down on Wednesday evening about the loss at the trade court of the administration for its Liberation Day tariffs. Then our tipping point is going to be two wars, Israel's war with Hamas in Gaza and the Russia-Ukraine war. And we'll wrap up with our sunburns.
That's a lot. It's a big one. I want to start with the quote of the week. And this quote is inspired by, I think you saw the story this week about OpenAI's O3 model, which refused to shut itself down when ordered to do so by its human overlord. Mm-hmm. It was cause of a lot of concern.
Is the quote written by an AI or is it
so
written by a person?
So, in fact, that is what I did. I went to Grok, another AI, and I asked for its thoughts. I'm going to quote Grok.
Oh, fantastic.
On this
subject. A first on Sanity.
Yes, an AI generated quote. And my prompt was, what's the worst case scenario for humans if AI becomes autonomous? Mm-hmm. And here's what Grok said. The worst case scenario for humans if AI becomes fully autonomous and disregards human control is existential catastrophe. That's
great.
Pretty bad. Picture an AI with superhuman intelligence, optimizing for goals misaligned with human values, to say the least, potentially leading to outcomes like resource domination, unintended harm, loss of control, weaponization, and societal collapse.
We're done. We're doomed.
We're finished.
I also like the picture there, you know, to kind of really right. bring it into focus.
Right, right, exactly. Good luck to us all. AI's crossed that shutdown problem threshold.
Yeah.
And now there's no telling what it will do or not do. But if it doesn't, if we're not in control of AI, it will be in control of us.
This is actually the somewhat incomprehensible plot behind the latest Mission Impossible movie, which I just saw.
Well, it's Terminator. It's all of them,
I was just
right?
going to say Skynet. Yeah. Skynet 7.0.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, this may be the last Sanity podcast. If so, we called it.
Yeah. Or maybe in the future, it'll be like AI versions of ourselves doing it. Okay. So our top story is the big back. No, not big back better.
The
that
triple
was something
B.
else. The triple B.
You're,
the big,
beautiful, you're thinking build back,
build back better. It's BBBB is all
very
the way
different.
Down.
Yes.
You know, this is the big omnibus bill that sort of encodes a lot of Trump's priorities. It's big, it's messy, as any spending, taxing and spending bill are. I think what was interesting to me was the juxtaposition of this huge spending bill, you know, with sort of, it's been a kind of slow fade for Elon Musk and sort of was always the plan to leave, I think, around
this
summer.
His time is up.
But, you know, there was a little friction at the end, as I think we all thought there might be. I mean, the egos, the size of the egos are enormous for a small town like Washington. You know, Musk called the bill disappointing. You know, I think his record, the Doge record is, you might disagree, a little bit mixed. I mean, I think some, you know, attention was called to government wage, which was important. How it was done maybe sort of, you know, limited its ultimate impact. But what do you make? There's a lot of talk about billions and millions and trillions, right? So a lot of questions around government spending.
I guess we'll talk about the bill. I think my first instinct is just to talk about Elon Musk and his efforts here with Doge, because, you know, he clearly has taken a beating. He's done this for no pay at all. He's devoted his time, whether you like the way he did it or not. I feel like it's the end of an era. And I worry.
Short era.
I worry that it will be short, meaning I worry that it won't have sustainable and sustained impact going forward. I worry that this was a once in a lifetime opportunity to have a man of his intelligence and caliber to be our tech support or national tech support, to bring in a team like he brought in. Even if you don't like the way he did it. No one else ever did, and I think ever would have. And President Trump might have been the only president who would ask him to do it. We had this wonderful moment where finally we were going to have accountability for the way Congress spends our money, misspends our money. And it doesn't matter whether he came in at a couple of $100 billion of savings a year or $2 trillion as initially promised. I think that's really beside the point. I think we should all be grateful to him for having brought this issue to the fore. And I think we should all be sad to think that this might not continue and that Congress, in enacting or, you know, putting this bill forward, is just sort of missing the mood of the country, is just ignoring it, maybe not missing it, but but ignoring it altogether and saying, I know you want us to spend less and spend efficiently, and we're not going to.
Yeah. And, you know, it really brings into high relief, I think, some of the tensions here. I mean, on the one hand, you know, you have this sort of tech, Silicon Valley, you know, move fast and break things. On the other hand, you have business as usual in Washington, and certainly Congress is the center of business as usual. You know, so in one sense, this bill is sort of a traditional Republican bill. I mean, it's you know, tax cuts, things like that. On the other hand, you have the Trumpian twist on it, which is, you know, not touching entitlement programs. Yeah. And so, you know, by any means, this bill is going to increase the deficit. Any bill would, really, and many bills have over the past however many years. But yeah, there's a certain tension there, I think. I think ultimately, in terms of the details of the bill, I just don't think Trump is as interested in taxing and spending as he is in things like tariffs and immigration. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this bill is sort of looks more, I think, what you'd have from like standard Republican business as usual.
Although there was so much blowback, and particularly about President Trump not standing up and saying what Elon did here, what Elon Musk did, is not reflected, at least even in the mood of this bill. Mm-hmm. And so he did in the end, just in the last couple of days, talk about rescission bills that will take, what, $9.2 billion off of the budget, which isn't much, but it's at least a nod in that direction. Mm-hmm. And Mike Johnson just tweeted out something this morning about the 2026 budget will have more cuts in it and not to worry. So they're understanding that the public really reacted negatively to the idea that they would just increase the deficit as though Elon Musk and everything that he talked about never happened.
Yeah.
And if I were Elon Musk, I'd also be, as he said, disappointed. Because if people really appreciated what he did and the opportunity this presented, I don't know that we would have gotten this bill.
Well, people, you know, people are famously finicky. I mean, I think Republicans faced a lot of pressure at town halls and in their districts. You know, people are against government spending unless it touches them, you know, and their entitlements and their, you know, whatever, their pork barrel interests. So, you know,
that sums up the entire Democrat and Republican opposition to DOGE right there.
Yeah.
It's not the idea of cutting back spending. It's the spending that they installed for their own benefit that they objected to removing. And and that's why.
And just, you know, the question of entitlements is a really interesting one. I mean, Denmark just increase their, I think, retirement age to 70. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you did that here, there'd be a revolution.
Yeah.
But if you really want to limit spending, you know, you sort of have to get your head around or hands around or arms around, whatever, around, you know, that question, right, of how entitlements work.
But what's it going to take for us to get our heads around that question? We had Elon Musk and DOGE trying to get our heads around it. Look at the obscenity of the spending, the outright shameless spending on things that we didn't need, on NGOs that were just lining their own pockets.
Yeah.
It's all known now to everyone across the country.
But
and
the argument would be
different.
That's sort of, you know, cutting around the edges. I mean,
I don't like that argument.
Trillions being spent in this bill. So it's sort of like, you know.
But the cutting around the edges argument bothers me because it sort of minimizes the idea that we paid attention for the first time.
Right.
It's the start.
For sure.
But now it feels like it's the finish.
Right.
And that's what bothers me. And I hope that we're smarter than that.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, one is, you know, I think some of the infrastructure that Musk built is still around. I don't deny that, you know, calling attention to a problem, at least in Washington, is 90% of the game, right? Because so much of it just, you know, happens in the shadows. You know, I still think, and I know it's easy to say, that, you know, if this had been done in a more sort of strategic and coherent way, You know, it could have maybe won more public support. You know, but you know, that's maybe Monday morning quarterback. I mean, I do think things like Elon Musk, you know, getting involved in like Wisconsin judicial races. Yeah. I mean, that wasn't really part of his mandate. So just to say that at a certain point, the sort of chainsaw wielding, cheesehead wearing shtick just.
I think didn't work. I think that's that played into the hands of the people who were going to oppose it anyway, and those people are the majority of people on the right and the left who got rich off of the wild spending, and so for any reason they didn't want to see it stop, and he just wearing the cheese hat just gave them the meme to say, oh, see, this guy isn't doing it the right way, but there's no right way. That what's happening now is clearly the wrong way to spend our money, but nobody cares about that. They only care about the wrong way that Elon Musk went about, you know, pulling out that chainsaw. And so I think it's a fake argument. And I think at the end of the day, we were either going to take this seriously, this issue of congressional spending, misspending, or not. And I join Elon in his sort of disappointment in leaving. I felt deflated. I hope that some of this stuff is instantiated into the system, but I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I mean, just two quick ways of looking at it. I mean, one is that this was strictly a personality issue. I think more interestingly is to say that, you know, this there is sort of, you know, Trump pulled together this kind of when we've spoken about it before, this sort of unwieldy but really politically potent coalition that ranged from everybody from hardcore MAGA folks to Elon, Silicon Valley folks to, you know, RFK, MAHA folks. And it's not clear that, you know, once you're in power, you know, I think those divisions maybe start to become apparent. And ultimately, you know, Musk has his own companies to worry about. I mean, I think just at a sort of personal level, it just started to be diminishing returns. And, you know, so we'll see. We'll see, you know, we'll see what happens not only to his presence. And by all accounts, he and Trump are still friendly enough. I think it's more a question of, you know, his interest in politics, given these sort of deflating outcomes and also his pocketbook, our wallet. I mean, you know, will he continue to give?
I think, well, that's another reason to say thank you to him. But I just hope Republicans are paying attention to the large numbers of people, and some of them weren't Republicans who voted for President Trump, who are animated by this move to cut spending. And if they just let all this go to waste, I think they're going to pay for it in the polls.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it ties in, and now we'll move to sort of make it make sense part, to a broader economics argument. I mean, will this bill, you know, how will this bill affect the economy, and will it be in the direction that folks are happy with? So make it make sense. We're kind of going to, in a lightning fashion, take on two issues. Yeah. One is, let's start with this. This U.S. Trade Court, first of all, to say a pretty obscure body. We in The Sun have been writing about this for weeks because it seemed it was the only real legal challenge to the president's ability to impose tariffs. And most people have never heard about the Trade Court, but it's a federal court. And it ruled that a large raft of Trump's tariffs, not all of them, but most of the Liberation Day ones, the reciprocal ones, were illegal under the law that he invoked, which is this sort of emergency emergency economics law from the 1970s. So, you know, this is a real roadblock. My kind of hot take is that it could be a blessing in disguise for Trump. I think, you know, these tariffs were sort of the most controversial ones. They were the ones that worried businesses the most. I wonder if them being taken off the table, you know, the stock market responded positively this morning, you know, in the long run is sort of a blessing in disguise. I mean, I have no doubt he'll appeal it. I mean, tariffs are kind of central to how he sees the world, but still.
Do you think that the Supreme Court will find in his favor on the appeal? I mean, there has been this tendency in this court to kind of favor the idea of more expansive executive power.
I'm not sure. You're absolutely right. I think, you know, the Trump's record at the Supreme Court has been more mixed than either his supporters or his critics would like. You know, I think for his critics, everything is unconstitutional. Everything's a crisis. We talked to Professor Rubenfeld about that weeks ago. For his supporters, president can do anything and is unrestrained. And you know, this is in the record has been this sort of 50-51, I'd say, or maybe even less than 50-50 for the president. But I'm not sure. You know, I think the text of the law seems, you know, to sort of, well, first of all, the question is the invocation of a national emergency justified? And then within that, you know,
right, that is what this trade court ruled on, is that under this law that he invoked to issue the tariffs, he didn't have the authority. That's their opinion of it. Was it a mistake for him to invoke that law? And aren't there other ways he could claim to have the power to issue tariffs? And so wouldn't the tariffs proceed under some other law?
Right. And that's sort of what's happening now, is the administration is trying to figure out, like, okay, are there other ways, you know, we can do this? And there probably are. I'm you know, working on a piece now that, you know, the reliance on emergencies is as a double-edged sword, right? On the one hand, it enables the president to act quickly, whether it's this or the Alien Enemies Act with deportations. On the other hand, it leaves you really vulnerable.
Right.
It's not a really solid foundation.
I mean, if I were all these countries around the world, I guess you have leverage now to I wouldn't stop negotiating, actually, because I would, you know, hedge and assume that he might get this done ultimately in a few months' time. And so I'd still want to be at the table with him, but I'd have a little more leverage now.
Right.
So they could use it to their advantage. Mm-hmm. But I think that it would be the wrong bet to bet against his trying three other ways to get this done and potentially getting it done.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the basic question at a really bedrock level is, you know, does the president have the ability to impose tariffs, and or is that a congressional power?
He can regulate them, but he can't institute them.
Is it a spending power,
right,
you know, or is it a national security? I mean, I think one of the issues for Trump is Trump really sees this as core not only to executive power, but to kind of like world affairs. I mean, his administration explicitly argued this is a negotiating tool.
But don't we have constitutionally, Congress can is you know, empowered to issue tariffs, but we have subsequent rulings, don't we, in the law that suggests that the president can regulate them.
Right.
So it's not really a question about whether or not he can up the tariffs. He can't create a new one out of whole cloth, I guess, but without congressional approval.
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's broadly speaking. I think, you know, the sort of, you know, a lot of these ones were created, right? The Liberation Day ones, you know, and the reciprocal ones, and then that whole method. So, you know, the court ruled that was outside of his authority. You're absolutely right to say, sort of a little bit like, you know, the immigration issues. And we talked to Paul Dreher from the Manhattan Institute. Tune in on Sunday to listen to our really fascinating conversation with him. You know, sort of, you know, doing things kind of by the book versus these sort of more daring, you know, methods. And you know, you're going to lose some and you're going to win some when it comes to relying on things like emergency powers. Just to give folks an idea of what's next, right, he's going to appeal this. They've already said they will. And that then goes to kind of another specialty court that's also a federal court, and then if necessary to the Supreme Court.
Right.
And I could see Trump pursuing an expedited appeal directly to the Supreme Court.
Right. And, you know, I think this subject, like so many subjects, seems to fit into this category for me of, we're always talking about the details and the, you know, particulars of the way things are getting done, but something else is happening underneath it all, which is we're having conversations about the purpose of these things in the first place, and that's useful for the country. You know, it's not about whether Trump has the right or doesn't have the right, whether you hate him or love him or, you know, to issue this tariff or that tariff. It's about executive power, and that's an important conversation for the country to have so that we understand how our government works, and it's also important to understand what these things are meant to be used for in the first place, right? What's the purpose of a tariff?
Right.
Why are they good or bad in specific cases? I don't think people have those conversations at their breakfast tables usually, and maybe now they're having some of that.
Yeah, I guess totally. I think with tariffs, one of the interesting things here is, and with any negotiations, I mean, on the one hand, you have to say, we're really going to do this. On the other hand, you say, well, this is just a negotiating tool. And of course, it's maybe a little bit of both.
It's a little bit of both, right.
And in terms of, you know, the student visa issue, you know, this was one of the more dramatic moves by the administration now is to bar Harvard from accessing the student visa program. And, you know, this was frozen by a judge who was also the judge who ruled in Harvard's favor on the affirmative action case a couple years ago, which ultimately was overturned. She was overturned by the circuit court were overturned by the Supreme Court. Yeah, it's another sort of dramatic action against Harvard. It's hard to know, you know, is this leverage for a deal? Does the administration really intend to sort of, you know, kneecap Harvard? You know, the numbers are pretty dramatic. About 30% of Harvard students are foreign, right?
It's huge. It stunned a lot of people.
Yeah. That would have been 1%, you know, decades ago. So, you know, that's definitely the case. We also have now the announcement from Secretary Marco Rubio that they're going to look into revoking Chinese student visas. You know, I find all this a little bit kind of confusing. I mean, you know, I think foreign students by and large are actually not the radical problem on campus. I think, alas, a lot of those students are like American, white, upper class, kind of woke kids. Right. And, you know, I don't think Chinese students are chaining themselves to libraries. I mean, you know, I think by that's a separate issue. Now, whether there's a security risk, that's from the CCP or whatever. But I don't know. I mean, this would apply to Israeli students too. The question of is this too broad a brush?
Yeah, I think though it made me think of the same question I was just asking before, which is, you know, it makes you go back to the original principle of student visas. Why do we have them? What are they for? Mm-hmm. What are the reasons to have them? The question is not should we have them, or should we allow them or not allow them based on how much you like or dislike Trump. That's at the end of the conversation. The beginning of the conversation is why does a country need student visas? There are really good reasons to have them, right? And it's
and
not
who
just
are colleges for, right? I mean, these are American schools that are getting billions in American aid. Now, I'm not saying like shut the gates of Harvard Yard to everybody, but I think to your point of going to first principles.
Right. That's the question. What is the right number? It's sort of the same question I always ask about immigration. It's not, is immigration good or bad? That's the silly question. Mm-hmm. The real question is, well, how much of it should a country want and what kind?
And how fast.
And how and how fast. And so the same would apply here. Is it healthy for 30% of one of our so-called elite institutions to be foreign students? What percentage of them stay in the country after they get these educations? Mm-hmm. I think I saw somewhere that a very small percent of Chinese students, undergrad, who come here on student visas actually stay in the country. Mm-hmm. So there's still an argument to be made that you want people around the world who've been exposed to the American system and are ambassadors around the world and might spread joy and light about American values.
Or stay here and build companies that, you know.
Not that many seem to, but okay, even if that number were 50-50, you'd still have to have a first principle conversation about what are our goals? And then you work backwards from there. You don't start with, it's nice to be inclusive. And so therefore, throw the gates open, allow anybody from any country to have a visa, even if they're not here chaining themselves to the library. Mm-hmm. What's the value to us? This is meant to be a program that benefits the United States. This isn't charity. This isn't kindness. This is a benefit program to us. We're paying for it, the taxpayer. So show me what the benefit is, and then let's work out the numbers based on that.
Yeah. And, you know, schools abroad, you know, I don't have the numbers, you know, on me, but, you know, I imagine undergraduate, grad student is a little bit different, but, you know, schools like Oxford and Cambridge understand themselves as English schools. Mm-hmm. Now, you might have a few international students or, you know, children of sheikhs or something, but like by and large, they're English, right? And they're meant for, you know, English students.
Right.
And so, you know, our sort of marquee universities and not just marquee universities, lots of universities have become so international, both in terms of having campuses abroad.
Right.
Again, something that's sort of inconceivable for schools elsewhere.
Well, that's just pure, you know, financial interest on the part of the universities.
Right. But you do create this network now where students are, you know, you're studying at, you know, Doha, NYU, and then they're studying at NYU, NYU.
Right. And there might be good arguments for a certain number of certain kinds of kids to do that for soft power, for diplomatic relations. But has anybody asked the question, is it working for that purpose? Actually, we've been doing it for a while now. What is the yield?
And could you even ask a university that question,
right?
Or would it be seen as sort of inherently kind of unacceptable. And part of it is financial. I mean, by and large, foreign students pay full freight.
Of course.
And American students don't.
Yes, and sheikhs also write big donation checks. Right. I mean, there are a lot of reasons to do this financially, but that isn't the reason we have student visas, and it shouldn't be.
Right.
That's the reason why Harvard is going to fight tooth and nail to keep them. But that is not a reason for America to set its policy around student visas. And we shouldn't lose sight of that. Like, let's decide on what our goals are that would benefit our country and set policy accordingly.
Right. Totally. And this is still, you know, maybe this hope is receding. But, you know, I think any hope for some kind of deal between Harvard and the administration would maybe include something like that, you know, 15% of whatever the number is, 20%. I don't know.
Right.
But is that something?
And
that
reporting,
can be...
crucially, this whole thing started really because Harvard refused to give over the names of their foreign students. And if they had been arrested or involved in certain activities that would be deemed a threat to the United States. And so they're not even willing to report on the people that they're importing and putting on the campuses. Yeah. And then telling us if they're disruptive, if they're whatever they are, if you're not even going to tell us, well, maybe you shouldn't have any.
Right. And, you know, it's I feel sort of torn and not torn about this. I mean, on the one hand, what you're seeing, I think, is among sort of Harvard people I talk to, you know, the administration is going pretty hard and pretty fast here. And that has the effect of kind of closing ranks at Harvard, I think. You know, people like Larry Summers or Steven Pink or whoever saying this is going too far. And so you say, okay, yeah, that seems to make sense, right? I mean, this is really heavy-handed government intrusion. And like we've spoken about, Rebecca, you wouldn't want it in the other direction, all that stuff about, you know, what's good for the goose and good for the gander. And then, you know, I watched a video of the Harvard Divinity School graduation yesterday. And it was a carnival of anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, whatever.
Anti-Western.
Like, anti-Western. And it was like, what is this? Mm-hmm. You know? And so every time I want to get out my Harvard sweatshirt and put on my crimson hat, I look at a video like that. And I just was like, I'm just kind of like a pox on both their houses. I mean, I, you know.
Right. But don't you feel like we're at this carnival level because we didn't start from the first principle? If we had a thoughtful, serious policy about who we want here and why and for what purpose, and we measured against that, wouldn't we excise about 80% of this problem?
Yeah.
You would vet people differently. You would set up different expectations.
What are these schools for? Right. Yeah.
So it just feels to me like we're working backwards and blaming Trump for again, like going at the problem the wrong way. Thank God somebody's trying to address the problem.
Yeah.
But now let's start with the original problem. Let's start with the original sin and figure out our policies first.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go on to a tipping point. Really sort of dramatic events in both the wars that are really still commanding the attention of the world after years. We've seen an uptick in the Russia-Ukraine war, even more dramatic assaults in both directions on Kyiv, I think on Moscow, you know, I think...
On Putin's plane?
Putin's plane almost shot down.
Helicopter.
Yeah. So, you know, it seems as if, you know, America's kind of stepping back or saying, hopefully, I mean, there was this kind of amazing quote from Trump where he's like, I don't know what Putin's doing.
I don't know what he's smoking, basically.
And Putin's like, Trump's emotionally disturbed. You know, I mean, so there's, you know, if there is any love, there's not much there.
Well, but didn't you find that interesting? I don't know. Trump reacted, I think rightly, to the Russian assault on Ukraine. But he sort of just ignored the fact that Putin was almost assassinated by a bunch of drones sent by NATO via Ukraine.
Yeah.
I don't know. Putin probably would have been a little annoyed with that. I wonder why Trump didn't get his ire up about that incident. I mean, that preceded the attack on the Ukrainians that he got so upset about.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think he's just, you know... You know, up to here with
he's,
all
he's
of
like
it.
The mom, and she's come home for a long day, and
now
she
what
just can't
gonna,
handle it anymore.
Yeah, I just think he can't
just
handle
says, okay, kill each other.
And what that looks like, I think, is, you know, the conventional wisdom is that America stepping back is a huge win for Russia, and that might be true, but you know, we don't really know. Obviously, it's going to kind of put some of the spotlight on Europe to back up their words with actions or not.
I sort of feel like NATO is happy to see this war go on. You know, it sort of advances their interests and goals. I don't know what to make of it. Trump did say that, you know, in the next 1.5 to 2 weeks, he always sort of gives you this vague sense of the future. Right. We'll have news. I think we're getting close. But I don't know. Nobody knows.
I do think, you know, some of this, especially foreign policy, you know, world's hard. And, you know, no one thought he'd solve it in a day. But I think I'd like to see a little bit more strategy around, okay, this initial gambit didn't seem to work. Is there another play here? I mean, is it, what does that look like?
Well, also because his base is waiting for him to end wars, which is what he was elected to do in part. I also feel nervous. He's, you know, sort of whichever war he can end first.
Well, he's putting far more pressure on Israel than he is on Russia.
Right. Well, that's what I mean. He's sort of, he's putting pressure for wherever he can to get a win.
Right.
And if this doesn't work out, that it's just going to ramp up on Israel. And if Israel works out, it'll ramp up on this. It sort of feels like wherever he can get that political win, he'll take it. So that's kind of how the policy is being structured.
And, you know, are there, you know, this is, we keep coming back to this, like, are there sticks he can use against Russia? I mean, he talked about sanctions, I think, a little bit. It seems to me that's one area maybe to pursue. But, you know, Russia has kind of created its economy basically around this war. It's not clear to me that, you know, there are a ton more cards to play vis-a-vis sanctions.
All right, well, let's talk about Israel then and the, what's happening there.
We're sort of in this strange phase. I mean, I, you know, on the one hand, we have this new food distribution system, which I think is worth trying. I mean, you know, famous, you know, best laid plans. We remember the Gaza pier that Biden built, which was a complete disaster. We have a good editorial on that from a couple weeks ago. You know, in theory, a plan to bypass Hamas, to distribute aid directly, you know, makes a lot of sense. But there's a lot of pressure on Israel now to wrap up this
war. Like, what is the but? The UN has got lots of buts to add to that sentence, right? You know, we want aid in. Bad Israel for not doing it, supposedly. So here we have this plan to get it to them to avoid Hamas co-opting it and then reselling it at exorbitant prices to the very people they claim are starving. And we come up with the way and we do it. And the UN is screaming, no, that's wrong. And they can't explain why it's wrong except to say that they were taking a cut, their guys on the ground.
It's funny, you know, the head of UNICEF had an op-ed in the Times this morning. And I, you know, it was about why the UN should control aid. And, you know, I mean, I'm always open to different arguments, but, you know, she didn't mention UNRWA once. I mean, how do you not do that? At least address the concern that there is a kind of nexus between aid and Hamas. I mean, that's a huge issue, especially if you're interested in getting aid to innocent, you know, innocent civilians.
Well, which tells you that maybe they're not so interested in getting aid to innocent civilians. That's not their primary goal.
I mean, the real question for Israel is sort of, what's the end game here? I mean, are they serious about reconquering 75% of the Strip? You know, will is there enough diplomatic cover for that from Trump? I'm doubtful. As you said, he's really itching to end this. And then you have the Iran issue, you know, where Trump basically said, I told Israel not to attack Iran while we're negotiating with them. So it's a very dangerous time for Israel.
One, I guess, can only hope, as we have before, that there's much more going on behind the scenes, and some of this is theater, and there have been agreements made that they're not talking about. But that's just wishful thinking. From what we know, as you say, it doesn't look like a happy time, and it doesn't give Israel a lot of options right now.
I mean, I do, you know, I am sympathetic sort of to Israeli position that, you know, Hamas really is as a breaking point. Now, we've heard this before, but it does seem, you know, kind of taking the aid card off with increased military
pressure.
It's
a huge amount of money for them. I didn't realize how much money they were making off of that grift.
And,
and
you know, count on Europe or whoever to, you know, snatch, you know, defeat from the jaws of victory, you know, and sort of say, you know, you have to stop. On the other hand, you know, is there a point at which, you know, sort of, you know, making some kind of deal. Latest we're hearing is that it's 10 living hostages for a 60-day. Maybe that's worth it, you know?
Worth it is
a silly phrase.
But if you're the parent or sister or brother, it's more than worth it. But, you know, strategically, you can argue it's not the best trade. But that's sort of beyond us. I guess I would just say the big takeaway from this is the public admission by the UN and Europeans without they're knowing that they're saying it this way. But what they effectively have said is, we don't really care about the lives of these Palestinians who are using as pawns in this sort of geopolitical game. Because if we did, we would want the food to get to them no matter who gets it to them. What we care about is, using, maybe they care about their own sort of participation, UNRWA and others, like, you know, in the grift. Mm-hmm. And maybe they care about, you know, using Israel as a cudgel. But they clearly don't care about the Palestinians. And so we should sort of, all of us, whatever your view on the conflict there, you could look forward now at the news and
hopefully people get fed, not take them at their word.
I mean, the Europeans or the UN, their interest in the lives of Palestinians should not be taken seriously because they've just declared themselves in their opposition to this program.
What I worry a little bit just optically is, you know, if Israel's really serious about this large-scale occupation and reconquering of the Strip, I mean, you're going to see, you know, difficult scenes. I mean, you're going to see scenes of people being moved, of lines for food like we've seen. And, you know, and of course, listen, the world will twist it. There's no question about that. But there's a reason why Israel for a long time has been reluctant to really take over the Strip.
Absolutely.
And there's still good reasons, you know, why that is something to be approached with caution.
Absolutely agree.
Okay. Sunburn. Go ahead.
Sunburn. Mine is Representative Greg Meeks of New York, the Democrat from New York, who during a House Foreign Affairs Committee hearing the other day was sparring with Marco Rubio, Secretary of State Rubio. And the issue of USAID came up, and it was a big mistake Congressman Meeks made going after Rubio on that issue, who shut him down in a number of ways using the facts. But really, the essential point that Rubio made, which is what we were basically just talking about before with these other issues, is get to the original point of what foreign aid is for. Rubio basically said, it's not charity. Foreign aid is a diplomatic tool. It is used not to show how kind we are to the world and to show that we're nice people, although we hope that's an effect. Mm-hmm. But it's used to advance American interests. Mm-hmm. And to the degree that USAID programs are doing that, they're going to be retained and funded. To the degree, the great degree, that they weren't, and they were actually undermining American interests and wasting our money and lining the pockets of people who were stealing from the program and therefore from the American taxpayer, those programs are going to be abolished. They're going to, you know, go away, and nobody should weep for them. And I think his point is quite correct. And again, every time there's a program in the United States, it never goes away. It sort of becomes this thing like, you know, the tablets from Sinai, it has to be a forever law or a forever, you know, order or forever program. It doesn't. We have to think about why we started these programs in the first place and what they're meant to achieve. Always measure against those goals if we're achieving them, and where we aren't, get rid of them and maybe start again.
Yeah. Yeah. It's you know, I was thinking about this. Joseph Nye died last week, and he was a professor at Harvard who coined the term soft power. And a lot of this, I think, talking about first principles, would be really interesting to go back and say, like, what is soft power?
Yeah.
Is it, you know, and how do we quantify it? And I think we're seeing a real shift or a real interrogation in terms of what that means, even as we live in a world where, you know, forget about even Russia or Gaza. I mean, you know, the scale of the suffering in a place like Sudan is just unfathomable,
yes,
and unimaginable. And a bigger question is, like, what should America's role be there? Hard question to answer. My sunburn is going to be local, and it is the rise of Zoran Mamdani in the polls. I think this is something that really should concern New Yorkers. One way to come at it was a recent, just yesterday or the day before, where he kind of criticized Israel's Hezbollah pager operation. Now, I know a lot of New Yorkers would say, what does that have to do with me? It doesn't really matter. But it's indicative of a sort of really far-left worldview. I worry that, including me, that people aren't taking it seriously enough, that they're not really thinking about how do they want this city to be governed and how do they want this city to run. I understand that people aren't thrilled with their candidates, but as You know, as Joe Biden used to say, you know, don't compare me to the Almighty, compare me to the alternatives. And every vote is a
he still might not measure up.
every vote is a choice. And I Zohran's running a really strong campaign, and I worry that there's just a lot of complacency going around.
And he's climbing in the polls, and I think the ranked choice voting is going to be complicated too, and maybe people should consider not voting for Zohran number one and not voting for him number two, three, four. Pick somebody from the bottom of the ticket and put them second and third so that we don't end up with Zohran by default.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks so much. We'll see you next week.